he put his hand on the pile of rosaries, and then he cupped my other hand over it.
Senator Murkowski is awestruck after a moment with the Pope. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, writer Seth Kantner on his new book of essays.
I feel like I owe the land and animals a debt for all the years of just, you know, waking up in the morning and going, oh, I'm hungry, I'm going to go drag something home.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Governor Bill Walker today formally called the Alaska legislature back to Juneau for a third special session this year. His proclamation calls for considering two topics: a tax targeting undeveloped natural gas still in the ground, and buying out Canadian pipeline builder TransCanada's ownership stake in a proposed natural gas pipeline. In a press release, Walker likened the state's unproduced natural gas reserves as milk with no expiration date. He says taxing it serves as an insurance policy against the significant risk of never monetizing the gas. The TransCanada pipeline ownership buyout is a state option that closes at the end of the year under previous pipeline development agreements. The buyout would give the state more negotiating power with the other pipeline partners, ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and BP. In a press release, the governor said the gas line project has gone from a wish list item to a must-have because of the state's $3.5 billion budget deficit. Alaska's congressional delegation had an audience with the Pope this morning. Actually, all of Congress did, along with the president's cabinet and the Supreme Court. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Senator Lisa Murkowski did have a close encounter with Pope Francis, a personal moment that left her awestruck.
Murkowski was among a group of senators assigned to greet the Pope at the Capitol. She says lawmakers were instructed on decorum beforehand.
So we were lined up and we were told, stand with your feet together and your hands clasped in front of you. And if the Pope greets you, then you can greet him back.
The senator brought two strings of rosary beads with her to the Capitol, one made of Alaska jade that she thinks was a gift for her 25th birthday, and another from Brazil made of glass beads. Murkowski says she intended to just have them near the Pope, in his aura, as she put it. Then she had another idea.
And I stretched out my cupped hand full of two rosaries. And he looked at me, and he looked at the rosaries, and he came over. And he put his hand on the pile of rosaries. And then he cupped my other hand over it and blessed me.
Murkowski says she was too overcome to verbally greet the Pope. The senator next to her, Republican Susan Collins of Maine, did those honors.
So she provided the audio because I was absolutely just speechless. So I still have tingles from being in the immediate presence of His Holiness.
Both of Alaska's senators are Catholic, and each had a different takeaway from the Pope's address. Murkowski says she liked that he encouraged dialogue among leaders. Senator Dan Sullivan noticed that both in the House chamber and to the crowds waiting on the lawn outside, Francis emphasized the importance of children and families.
And you could see how sincere he was, particularly when he said it out here. But I also think, you know, the Pope is a wise man, and anytime you start a speech in that chamber with, it's great to be in the land of the free and the home of the brave, and end it with God bless America, you're going to be well received by everybody.
Alaska's lone House member, Don Young, and his wife spent the night before at his office to avoid getting caught in what was predicted to be a nasty traffic jam getting to the Capitol. Young's take on the pontiff?
He made a decent presentation. People were excited to see him, and I went and read his speech afterwards. It didn't have any earth-shaking statements in it at all, so it was good.
If Young sounds a little blasé about the experience, ask his wife, Anne Garland Young, what she made of it.
I thought it was thrilling and inspiring just to be in the same moment and in the same room with such an incredibly wonderful person who's very inspirational and obviously very holy, very close to God.
Could you feel that in the room?
Oh, absolutely. And I think just about everyone in that room really experienced the same thing. It was very beautiful, very moving.
Once the Pope departed, it was back to business at the Capitol, where the race is on to pass a spending bill to avoid another government shutdown. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
After the Pope left the Capitol, the U.S. Senate took another procedural vote on a bill to defund Planned Parenthood, this one linked to a stopgap measure to fund the government. Senator Murkowski was one of eight Republicans to vote against advancing the bill. She sided with Democrats who say cutting Planned Parenthood funds would limit access to health care and contraception. As expected, the bill failed to get enough votes to move. Senate leaders have teed up another bill to fund government without the controversy. Planned Parenthood part. Murkowski is unpredictable on bills related to abortion. In August, she voted for advancing a bill to defund Planned Parenthood, saying she hoped to limit the bill's effects with a later amendment. Even a few hours before the vote this afternoon, Murkowski couldn't say which side she would choose.
I have made very, very clear to anybody that is within range of listening that I do not support shutting down the government, period.
But the senator says she doesn't believe federal funds should be cut off to all of Planned Parenthood.
Your reality is then those facilities in Alaska that provide for the STD testing, some of the other services will not have those resources. And that is very troubling. The women of Alaska, and I think the women around the country, need to make sure that they don't have a disruption in service.
Nationally, Planned Parenthood has been under fire after staff at some affiliates were videotaped discussing the harvest of aborted fetal parts. Laws already banned spending federal money for abortion, but anti-abortion groups say Planned Parenthood is able to perform more abortions because its clinics are supported with federal money. Murkowski also explained why she missed a vote on Tuesday on another abortion bill, that one to ban abortion after the 20th week of pregnancy. The senator says she was in Texas raising money for her reelection.
I had months and months ago made arrangements to do a fundraising swing and had put in place these plans at the early part of the summer.
Murkowski says she regrets missing the vote. The state's case against the two defendants in the Sockeye wildfire may not go to trial until sometime next year. At a court hearing in Palmer today, attorneys for defendants Amy DeWitt and Greg Immig asked Judge David Zwink for more time to prepare their case. DeWitt and Immig have pleaded not guilty to criminal charges of recklessly igniting the fire that swept through more than 7,000 forested acres north of Willow in June of this year. The fire destroyed 55 homes. A pretrial hearing in the case has been set for December 3rd. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a contentious assembly meeting in Haines on an ordinance that assigns fines to dozens of offenses.
It makes no sense. So you want to talk about losing the faith of the people? We don't trust you because you're insane.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Mexican consulate in Anchorage is closing to the public at the end of November because of budgetary reasons. Running the 10-person office costs about $500,000 each year. It opened in 2009 because the state was seeing an increase in the Mexican population, and Alaska's vast geography made reaching a consulate difficult. The American Community Survey by the U.S. Census estimates 28,000 people of Mexican origin live in Alaska. Only 40 people use the consulate for passport services last month. Eduardo Baca is the Mexican consul in Seattle.
Unfortunately, we can't have offices everywhere that there's, you know, a mid-sized community. We have places, states, that have over 200,000 Mexicans, and we don't have a consulate there. But the reality is that we can't have a consulate everywhere just because there are no budgetary, availabilities.
That includes states like Tennessee. Baca says they will still be providing consular services like issuing passports and other documents online, over the phone, and through a new Consulate on Wheels program. Throughout the summer, Nome's horizon is dotted with oil tankers, cargo vessels, and foreign icebreakers anchoring offshore to avoid the port's shallow depth. A recent stopover by the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Monroe raised questions about Nome's inability to host patrol vessels that help ensure the nation's security in the Arctic. KNOM's Emily Russell was aboard the Monroe and has this story.
Not long after Chinese warships teetered on the edge of American waters during President Obama's trip to Alaska last month, and amid high tensions between the U.S. and Russia, a recent visit by the U.S. Coast Guard put the nation's need for Nome's port expansion into stark relief. U.S. Coast Guard Captain Samuel Jordan says Arctic ports that can accommodate ships like the cutter Monroe are few and far between. While patrolling the Bering Sea, he says the Coast Guard would benefit from deeper dredging at Nome's port.
We take advantage of any port that we can bring the ship into, especially logistics-wise. Having another logistics hub for us is always beneficial.
Jordan captains the Monroe, and at Nome's current depth, he was forced to anchor the cutter miles offshore, ferrying goods and personnel to the docks in 25-foot dinghies. Just about half of the Monroe's crew came ashore to do volunteer work cleaning up the docks for the afternoon. The crew crossed paths with Mayor Denise Michaels, Harbor Master Lucas Stotz, and members of Nome City Council at the small boat harbor. The Nome reps had been invited for lunch aboard the Monroe. Donning Coast Guard-issued survival suits, the group hopped aboard one of the dinghies and set off into the choppy seas. Over chicken tacos, Mayor Michaels told the captain that Nome's inability to host Bering Sea patrol vessels, such as the Monroe, leaves not only the city or state, but the rest of the country vulnerable.
If you wanted to infiltrate the U.S., what more better place to do it than the Arctic? Because there is nothing. There is no homeland security, so it's just an interesting time for national security, homeland security.
Nome's role in national security has also been a topic of heated debate at recent Port Commission meetings.
The relationship with Russia and the geopolitical forces going on with our oil development and defense of our country just makes Nome even more important. And for us to ignore that would be a dereliction of duty.
At last week's meeting, Port Commissioner Roland Trowbridge used Nome's strategic location to advocate for deeper dredging. The current port expansion plan, which was finalized at a recent milestone meeting hosted by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, is to dredge to just 28 feet. But Port Director Joy Baker explains that, to meet the needs of cutters like the Monroe and additional Arctic support vessels, it needs to go deeper.
You can't call it an Arctic port if you can't accommodate the nation's icebreaker fleet. So that's why we've glommed on to the 36 number.
The 36 number being the depth needed by icebreakers to safely enter and dock in Nome. Back aboard the Monroe, the Nome delegation crunched through churros and quickly zipped back into their survival suits. While waiting to climb down the 20-foot rope ladder that hung off the side of the Monroe, Nome's mayor emphasized the importance of the Coast Guard's presence in the Arctic and Nome's role in national security.
We want more presence in the Arctic, and anything that we can do to promote the port of Nome is good for all of us.
While many hope the Monroe will someday be able to dock at a truly deep draft port in Nome, for now the Corps of Engineers is moving forward with its plan for a depth of 28 feet. It's clear, though, that a deeper depth would cut down on the number of dinghy trips and even aid in the Coast Guard's national security efforts in the Arctic. Reporting in Nome, I'm Emily Russell.
The contentious Minor Offenses Ordinance in Haines, an order that assigns fines to more than 200 violations, will take effect January 1st with an amendment to clarify who exactly can write the tickets. The ordinance passed Tuesday evening during a four-hour emotional roller coaster of a meeting. KHNS's Jillian Rogers reports.
There were tears, threats, applause, yelling, and a couple of Nazi references. But despite it all, the controversial Minor Offenses Ordinance passed 4-3 Tuesday evening at the Haynesboro Assembly meeting.
This smacks of Hitler and Nazism to me. I mean, some borough employee having the right to just blindly give a ticket, that's just crazy.
Please reconsider your vote and give the citizens of Haynes due respect.
That was Haynes residents Bruce Spencer and Dave Button. The ordinance takes violations that already exist in borough code and, according to borough staff, streamlines the enforcement process. The long list of rules has caused such an uproar because it is seen as excessive and overreaching. People are worried that they'll be cited for driving around with their family dog in the back of their truck or jaywalking on Main Street. It passed with the amendment that borough manager Dave Sosa develop a policy regarding who can issue citations, what training is required to do so, and what codes can be enforced. If the policy is approved by the Assembly, the Minor Offenses Ordinance will take effect on January 1st. The ordinance was also amended to reflect a few recommendations from the Government Affairs and Services Committee. Nearly 20 residents at the meeting spoke out against the ordinance, citing infringement on their constitutional rights and an unlawful process leading up to Tuesday's vote. Four committees were assigned to comb through the ordinance and make recommendations to the Assembly. Borough Clerk Julie Causey said at the meeting that she hasn't received any committee recommendations. Mike Danker asked where that information was and what happened at those committee meetings.
Do these committee meetings have a quorum? Are we dealing with a minimum number of committee members that made that decision? Was there public present? What was the discussion like? That's critical pieces of information to make decisions so the public knows what's going on. So that information was not provided. We've already violated, as a community, we've already violated two sections of code.
Early on in the four-hour meeting, Deputy Mayor Diana Lapham threatened to eject members of the audience for speaking out, applauding, and interrupting the proceeding. Reese Williams suggested she focus her energy on the matter at hand.
And if the people want to applaud someone's statement, so be it. Let it go. It's okay. They can applaud and we can relax.
One more outburst and I will have you removed from this room. Thank you.
When it finally came time to vote on the ordinance, the count went like this. Mike Case, Lapham, and Joanne Waterman voted in favor of passing it. Dave Berry Jr. and Ron Jackson voted against it. But when Causey asked George Campbell for his vote...
Campbell? I refuse to vote. We do not have the information from all the committees. We know that there's information out there. It violates the Open Meetings Act. I refuse to vote.
You have no authority to do so, sir, in code. It does not allow abstention.
I refuse to vote. Arrest me, call me in contempt, whatever.
The unorthodox move held up the process. After some discussion and research, Campbell's non-vote counted in the negative, causing a 3-3 tie. Many feel that the relationship between the Assembly and its constituents has been damaged as a result of this development. Kyle Ponsford spoke twice at Tuesday's meeting. He finished with this after the ordinance passed.
It makes no sense. So you want to talk about losing the faith of the people? We don't trust you because you're insane. And I use that word insane on purpose because your mind isn't working right.
It was clear Tuesday from those who spoke that they feel the Minor Offenses Ordinance needs work before it is implemented. That they can agree on. The first working group meeting takes place on October 2nd at 6:30 in Assembly Chambers. Reporting in Haines, I'm Jillian Rogers.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Rural CAP commemorates 50 years of delivering early childhood education programs like Head Start and Parents as Teachers. Signature housing programs, including weatherization, self-help housing, and permanent affordable housing, make a difference in our communities. AmeriCorps members and elder mentors have positive impacts to education, health, and the environment. Learn more at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
thousands of cans of Bristol-based sockeye will make their way to school lunches and other federal food programs around the country this winter as part of a USDA bailout. KDLG's Molly Dishner has more.
Icicle Seafoods in Peter Pan will fill warehouses around the country with half-pound cans of salmon as part of the USDA's effort to address the glut of sockeye on the market. Trident and Ocean Beauty also submitted bids to the United States Department of Agriculture, but didn't offer the low price necessary to get the contracts. The purchase comes as good news for the sockeye market, which had a surplus of fish after two summers of large harvests, says UAA economist Gunnar Knapp.
If the USDA comes and says, well, we will buy up some of that salmon, why, that takes some of that production out of the regular market channels that it would go to, and it can make a very significant difference in helping processors to get a higher price.
The USDA announced this summer that it would purchase up to $30 million worth of canned sockeye through its Emergency Food Assistance Program to address the glut of sockeye already on the market. Funding for the purchase came from import tariffs. The salmon will be delivered to warehouses around the country over the next 5 months. But it'll be a while before Alaska knows how many cans are coming back to the state. Here's Food Bank of Alaska Executive Director Mike Miller.
When the USDA buys a commodity from any state, it is fair shared out to all of the states based on, you know, the level of need, the level of poverty, and other commodities that they have in their system. So it's very possible we will see some, but it's unlikely that we'll see the majority of it.
In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
Most authors struggle to get their work noticed at all and would love to get a phone call by a publisher asking them to write something. But when an editor called Northwest Arctic resident and writer Seth Kantner asking him to write about caribou, this was his response.
And I said, no.
Kantner will be the first to admit that he can be a bit cranky when it comes to managing his work. He wanted to get a collection of essays and columns published, and he says he got along okay with the editor who had called, so they compromised. The book of essays was published this month and is called Swallowed by the Great Land.
So I didn't just hang up on her, and I said, well, how about my book of essays? So we came to the agreement that if I did the caribou book for them, they would do the essay book. Pretty quick in the project, they got excited about the essay book. Pretty quick in the project, I got not excited about the caribou book. So we wrangled our way through that. I am working on the caribou book now, and Swallowed by the Great Land is out. So they went ahead and did that first.
All right, well, let's talk about Swallowed by the Great Land. I love the title, first of all. How did that come to you?
I wish it did come to me, but it came to somebody else. A couple years ago, I want to say three, maybe, when the German survivalist went missing in the Ambler Valley, and it became sort of almost like the Into the Wild white boy in the bus story, not to that extent, but there was a big search for this German guy, and newspapers were writing stories. The family came up, stayed with us, and I ended up getting involved with them searching and wrote a story. Well, Anchorage Daily News put the head on it, Swallowed by the Great Land. I like that. And then the only other thing I'll say is up until most of the way through this project, it was called Arctic Homeboy, which I was horribly embarrassed about. And so near the end, we had a little wrangling and swapped it out. Yeah, which is part of the business.
Would you say that there's sort of like a theme that emerges, or in the past, the books that you've written have been based, well, your first book especially, was a fictional characterization of a lot of the events from your own life. And then the second book, Shopping for Porcupine, was a collection of stories and also about a lot about your life and your parents and your brother. How about these stories? Are you looking to have a particular message in them, or is it just observations from your life?
I feel like I owe the land and animals a debt for all the years of just, you know, waking up in the morning and going, oh, I'm hungry. I'm going to go drag something home. And so at this point, I feel like, you know, there's dangers to the land and the animals, be it, climate change or certain development or certain ways of hunting or something. But yeah, I'm writing about home and people and animals. And then and definitely big changes. You know, some of these past winters, when we have rain every month, is not the way it's supposed to be, and I write about stuff like that too.
Are there particular essays or columns or stories that are in there that are some of your favorites that really stand out and you want to highlight?
Yeah, maybe the third or fourth one is, I think we ended up titling it Wolf Eyes. It's, that was about a wolf that we ran into along the river that was limping, and my daughter and her her friend from the village had just opened these boxes of Rice Krispies and gotten these little plastic step counters. And so they were scurrying around the hill, and I was thinking, holy cow, you guys already walked like 3,000 steps this morning. And they were chasing a porcupine up and down the trail, and caribou were crossing the river. And then we went for a boat ride and ran into a moose and a bear and beaver and otter and whatever else. And then it's all the same day. And then we ran into this limping wolf who had his own step counter, you know, the pain of stepping on a broken leg. I guess, you know, I just kind of glued those little Mickey Mouse step counters in with nature and wild animal. And I was happy with how it came out. I liked it, which is, I don't usually say that about my writing.
What are your thoughts about what you'll read to the audiences? And will you change what you read to Alaskans as opposed to what you read to other people?
Lori, it's incredibly nerve-wracking when you have all the weird little tics that I do. But if I see one person in the audience that I've seen before, and luckily I can't recognize people, but if I see one person, then I panic and don't read what I plan to because they might have heard it before. And so I never really know what I'm going to read, and I absolutely never know what I'm going to say. And trying to plan doesn't work for me because I forget what I planned.
Seth Kantner will be reading from Swallowed by the Great Land tonight at the Lusac Library in Anchorage at 7 p.m. On Friday, he'll be in Talkeetna, Saturday, Juneau, and Sunday in Haines, and then to the Lower 48 to continue his book tour. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Ellen Lockyer in Palmer, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Emily Russell in Nome, Jillian Rogers in Haines, and Molly Dishner in Dillingham. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. October 6th is REAA Election Day. Polls are open 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. You'll be voting for REAA school board candidates. When you go to vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the list or you don't have ID, you may vote a question ballot. The question ballot updates your voter registration. If you need language or other assistance while voting, ask the election board or bring somebody to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.